Now then, just press this. Thoughts, ideas, that which occurs. I am still in possession of all my faculties. I have my eyesight, which is acute, my hearing, which is keen, with the aid of neither spectacles nor deaf aid. For these things I am grateful, having attained a certain age. I have not caught Alzheimer's disease. No. A metaphor may come to my assistance at this stage. I often think of my life as a steeplechase. The Grand National, if you will. That's pure vanity. She'll hate me for that. Scrub Grand National? No, as you were. Where was I? One has faced one's canal turn, one's chair, one's beaches brook, and one now enters the final furlong with but a few fences left to jump. To run that final furlong in a fog and not know when one was approaching the winning post, or indeed when one had passed it, would be most unfair, painful even.
In The Final Furlong by Christopher Reason, the part of the old man is played by Bernard Cribbins. The Final Furlong.
So, one is immensely grateful to one's newfound faith in God, perhaps, that one has been spared that final indignity. One does not choose to dwell on one's childhood. Boys will be boys, etc., etc. Boys will be boys. There were no other boys. Father's study was oak-panelled and dark, every wall lined with books, leather-bound volumes I was forbidden from touching, and it was to that room I was summoned every evening, having taken my supper with cook down in the basement. He would sit writing at his desk. He would rarely, if ever, look up, whilst I would decline or conjugate a list of specified Latin nouns and verbs, amo, amas, amat, I love, you love, he loves, etc., etc. And no matter how buried he was in his work, he never failed to seize upon a mistake. He had devised a sophisticated system of rewards and punishment designed to ensure that I took this education seriously. The grand prize for an entirely error-free week would be a copy of The Magnet, Billy Bunter and his chums. The punishment for failure. One learned one could not afford to fail. You think of me as cruel, he would say to me as he replaced on the coat hook the riding crop he reserved for such occasions. It's not I that's cruel. Life is cruel. The sooner you get used to it, the better. There was fun. Of course there was fun, albeit somewhat circumscribed, usually involving the household staff. Father was a strict man with set ideas, but consistent, ever fair, and at certain festivals, birthdays, etc., he might even become involved himself. Conkers, the bobbing of apples, fun, that sort of thing. And, of course, there had been Nanny. No more booze after this. Keep your clarity, man, your sense of purpose. She seemed immensely old, Nanny, that is. When one is 4 or 5 years old, no doubt the entire world seems old. I doubt now she was more than 20. There was a photograph, probably thrown away in amongst all the clutter at the time of my second wife's death. Clissold Park, rather grand in those days. The little zoo, I believe it's still there. In the photograph, Nanny is enfolding my hand in hers, and I'm holding out a sugar lump, perhaps, to a goat. And Nanny is smiling fondly at me, wearing the type of cloche hat so fashionable in those days. Certain images that have come back to haunt me in dreams, or that twilight world between sleep and wakefulness. Her breath on my cheek when tucking me up at night. The smell of the starch on her uniform. Her laugh. She used to laugh a lot. Never in Father's presence, though, I hasten to add. A copper bracelet with a clasp and a unicorn inscribed, of which I was inordinately fond, and with which she let me play. Just little things, really. I also remember her eyes. The bright blue of a summer sky, and the soft coo of her voice. Who's my darling little boy? Nothing more than fragments. Then, suddenly, one day, she was gone. No explanation to me, of course. Just a new nanny, an elderly lady, kind, efficient, didn't stay long. Then a whole succession, one after the other. They blur. But that first nanny... How I regret the loss of that photograph. The link. It wasn't until many years later I was about to go up to Oxford that my father, in a rare moment of candour, let slip the reason for her dismissal, vouchsafed to me in the context of a warning as to my own conduct. It reflected his all-too-orthodox views on sexual morality. He refused to elaborate details beyond the bare facts, but there was a man involved somewhere, and a baby. Enough, certainly, to warrant instant dismissal. Who took the photograph? Certainly not Father. Who was with us that day in Clissold Park, I wonder? Whose was the camera? And who gave me the photograph? Was that her parting gift? Did she mean me to remember her? So, it serves little purpose to dwell on one's childhood. Is any of this relevant? Is this what she wants to hear? What are you trying to do, make her feel sorry for you? Or are you just feeling sorry for yourself? What would my father have said? Life is cruel, so get on with it.
Self conquers the bobbing of apples. Fun, that sort of thing. And, of course, there had been Nanny.
Sentimental nonsense.
Fun, that sort of thing.
Let's just get all the Father stuff out of the way once and for all, and then it's done. The rift must have occurred soon after leaving Oxford. I suppose one had always, since one could ever remember, felt somehow blamed by him. But it wasn't until I had settled upon a career that all the simmering resentments boiled over, because Father had already made a decision about my future, and it didn't correspond with mine. One evening, over dinner, he made an announcement. He had come to the conclusion that a commission in the armed forces might yet be the thing to make a man of me. I said, Father, I want to be a teacher. He said, you'll do no such thing. I said, my mind is made up. And with a defiant flourish, I pushed back my chair and left the room. He ordered me out of the house, vowed never to speak to me again, stated bluntly that I had failed him and desecrated my mother's memory, the only occasion upon which I can ever recall him mentioning her. I was under a great deal of pressure to go to his funeral. I resisted it, which was to sever the last flimsy connections with the more far-flung members of the family. But then he didn't mention me in his will, so we were quits, as our American friends might say. Regrets about that, of course. One was young and stubborn. Perhaps, as someone once suggested, we were simply too alike. I still have all my faculties, eyes, ears, my mind, that sort of thing. For these things I remain grateful. A metaphor. I often think of my life as a steeplechase. One has faced one's canal turn, one's chair, one's beecher's brook, and one now enters the final furlong with but a few fences left to... Have I been here before? Nevertheless, a great influence. Certain aspects of him. Integrity, no doubting that. My father, that is. Proud man. That has been said of me. Arrogant. Well, yes. I have views, I stick to them. People get upset. One finds oneself losing friends. The price one pays. Is this relevant? Is it interesting? Is this what she wants?
Fun, that sort of thing.
Skip straight through, ignore all the father stuff, waste of time. And let's face it, man, you were putting a bit of a gloss on it. You never stood up to him like that at all. You took the coward's way out and wrote him a letter instead. Let's try and stick to the facts, eh? Tell it how it was. That's what she wants, so that's what she'll get. So forget it. Go on to the marriage. My first marriage was not perhaps the success for which one might have hoped. There were problems, right from the start, problems of a bedroom nature upon which one should perhaps not choose to dwell. Suffice it to say that that which some writers of literature have described as the supreme sacramental conjoining of two human beings, respecting and honouring one another in the crowning act of love, she chose to regard merely as, well, as her duty. Not that one should necessarily lay all the blame at her door. This was another world, another time. My own initiation into what were then euphemistically termed the facts of life had occurred some years previously, on my 16th birthday. Father presented me with a passage from a medical textbook subtitled Human Reproduction. Having read and digested it, he asked if I had any questions. I said no. He said good and left the room. And that was that. There was, however, a longing for a child, on her part particularly. I was by no means averse to the idea. The notion did sustain the marriage, or at least the physical aspects of it, for a number of years. Sadly, hope is not an inexhaustible commodity. It runs out. One faces facts, one comes to terms, one comes to accommodations. One does not choose to dwell. Is this in good taste? Would she be interested in the details? Can all be changed later. Press on. Similarly, my career, although not without its minor triumphs, I can look back fondly, for instance, to the publication in 1956 of my English-language textbook, An Approach to Grammar, which did surprisingly well, particularly in New Zealand, curiously enough. And there were one or two other ventures which I can review with a certain degree of pride, but all in all, if one is honest, and I like to think of myself as honest, it must be said that my career has not been characterized by the kind of success that I might have envisaged for myself when I first climbed into the saddle, to pursue the steeplechasing metaphor. It was the boys. I chose to work foolhardy, is the word that always springs to mind. But I was fueled by this naive desire to do the right thing. I chose to work in the East End of London, Canning Town. Or was it just all part of the same attempt to revenge myself on Father? No, I did believe. But there was also this sense that if I was going to do this thing, then I may as well go the whole hog. Not a public school, not even a grammar school, but an elementary school. Secondary modern was the new phrase, though the epithet modern was sadly misplaced. Bomb damaged, Nissen huts, that sort of thing. Poverty, a lot of that. I was possessed by this idea that I wasn't going to use corporal punishment, you see. No need to go into the reasons, I just thought it wrong. I'd made a vow at a very young age, and I intended to stick to it. The other teachers thought me a fool, said so to my face, but I had absorbed some notions fashionable at the time which claimed that care and compassion in moderation for the boys, well, that in the end those values would win them round. We have to learn to love. That's what we're here for. That was your phrase. Do you remember? And I think, looking back, that was maybe what I was trying to do. the way I fought to organise that trip to the National Gallery, and to be proved so conclusively wrong, to be let down so badly, the I-told-you-sos from the staff room, the laughter behind cupped hands. One learns one's lessons. But I stuck at it, for as long as I could, that is. Endured the humiliations, the chewing gum on the chair, the jeering, the homework that was set but never handed in, the obscenities on the blackboard, and even they were misspelt. Until, in the end, I learned to wield the strap with the best of them. It's fear, you see. It's unpleasant, but it works. After a fashion, keeps the lid on. It's not me that's cruel, I would say to myself. It's life that's cruel. But perhaps one shouldn't choose to dwell. There were successes, one or two. I still remember their names. The one who was to go to Ruskin and later to become a prominent campaigning journalist, appearing regularly as a pundit on radio and television. Many years later, he was to write a lengthy article defending the principle of comprehensive education. "We have to have faith in our children," he wrote. "We must nurture them and care for them." And then added, parenthetically, that had it not been for the belief displayed in him by a certain English teacher many years ago, then he would not be writing this article now. I cut it out and kept it. Many was the time when, at a low ebb, I would take it from the drawer and steal a glance at that particular paragraph. Yet another little memento that went missing after my second wife's death. So, not entirely without compensations. And there was always an approach to grammar which was quite favourably reviewed by much of the educational press, and its follow-up, a new approach to grammar. A sentence should not end with a preposition. It's not hard, it's not difficult, nor is there any need to split an infinitive. It's ugly, it's unnecessary. There is such beauty inherent in the formal structure of the English language, and it pains me so to... I'm on my high horse. It doesn't become me. But does anyone so much as give a damn any more? Is this relevant? Who would care? Why should she give a damn about any opinion of mine? No more booze. But maybe a drop of water. I've got my faculties, that's the main thing, the eyes, the ears, etc., etc. Not gone down to Alzheimer's disease, etc. Steeplechase, final furlong, etc., etc. My first marriage, chiefly characterized by disappointment and disharmony, was to stand in marked contrast to the joy and happiness I was to discover with my second wife. Yes, this is more like it. Who was to exhibit all the charms, graces, and indeed enthusiasms which my first spouse so sadly lacked. Don't want to put the old dragon down too much. Sounds callous. Maybe you should say you were sorry when she died. Yes. There was regret at her passing, of course. Sadness, grief, sorrow, not a few tears. God, I can't bear hypocrisy.
Arms, graces, and indeed enthusiasms which my first spouse so sadly lacked.
Tell the truth, for God's sake. Be honest. That's the whole point of this, isn't it? Tell it how it was. She was pure bloody hell to live with, and you couldn't believe her luck when she... I'll just leave it as it is. It'll do. Where was I? Enthusiasms which my first spouse so sadly lacked. I was 52 years old. After 27 years of wandering thirsty through the desert, I had stumbled upon a verdant oasis. She was attractive, funny, witty, amusing, rejoicing in all the finer things of life. She adored clothes, perfumes, the theatre, jewellery, eating out, foreign holidays, and anything that was new and exciting. I had lived a somewhat confined existence up until then. My first wife, within a few years of our first getting married, had been rendered housebound by a neurological condition which induced severe anxiety attacks whenever she ventured further than the front door. The consequence of this was that even on a modest teacher's salary, along with the royalties from two widely distributed English language textbooks, substantial savings had accrued. So, right from the start, my new wife and I were ideally suited. She with her zest and passion for life, and I with the wherewithal to indulge them. And let me point out that my new wife was gracious enough to do me the very great honour of describing me as a wonderful lover. Our sex life was full and varied. 'Twas indeed a veritable feast following the famine. This is just boasting, but if it's true, and it is, something puts you in a good light, you don't want to put it in. Hang it all, keep it in. If it's true, keep it, all of it. Perhaps my only regret is that my new wife's appetites were such that they could not be confined to the narrow restrictions imposed upon them when we first undertook our marriage vows. Perhaps one shouldn't choose to dwell. Let's just say we came to understandings, accommodations. The fact is, I was happy to compromise. She had set me free. After almost 30 years of meaningless struggle at the lower end of the state sector of education, she had persuaded me to forsake my foolish and outworn principles and apply for the post of head of English at a boys' private school in Kensington. By happy chance, it was one of the few schools that was still using an approach to grammar, despite the fact that it had been out of print for some 10 years. It stood me in good stead. I got the job. The boys were well-spoken, polite, motivated, and possessed the prerequisite intelligence to distinguish a verb from an adjective, on top of which the hours were congenial, and the salary a very substantial improvement on that which I had hitherto been receiving. These were the best years of my life. I was happy and fulfilled, both at work and at home. The fact that my wife, picking up on certain ideas current at the time, was a firm believer in what she termed modern marriage, did, I must confess, precipitate a certain degree of anxiety on my part. But one learned to adapt. One had lived 30 years in a cave. The sunlight was always bound to hurt one's eyes. I was, of course, aware of wagging tongues. I simply chose to ignore them. Friends and colleagues, no doubt from the best of intentions, would be seen occasionally to be summoning up their courage. After a long and tortuous preamble, they would seek to insinuate and then finally venture to suggest that I was, what was the phrase employed by one of them? I was being made a monkey of. How well I remember the look of shock and embarrassment on his face when I confronted him with the fact that I was fully aware of all my wife's indiscretions, that we had an arrangement, and that furthermore I was more than happy with the situation. Which wasn't entirely true, it must be confessed. There were lonely evenings, certainly dark nights of the soul, when my imagination and fantasies threatened to spill over into rash deeds and acts of bloody revenge. But what the gossips didn't realise, and what one could never grasp if one didn't know her as I did, was how easy she was to forgive. There was a childlike quality to her that was utterly beguiling. One was swept along by it. One adored her. One couldn't help oneself. The shock of her death is something from which I have never fully recovered, even after all these years. It was not so much the circumstances of her death, lurid though they were. The whole thing was an accident, and the coroner made that quite clear. But there were two young men with her at the time. That they were over the age of consent was neither here nor there, for the fact is, I was housemaster to both of them, and that was enough to generate a great deal of most unwelcome publicity that made one's teaching position quite untenable. The boys in question were both expelled, 3 months before they were to sit their A-levels, a source of profound regret. But that wasn't the worst of it, nor the fact that one was to learn, following the funeral, that certain debts of rather overwhelming proportions had been run up, of which one had been entirely unaware. No, it was none of those things. It was the loneliness, the realization that I was utterly and completely alone in what was now a meaningless and sterile universe. To have experienced an all-too-brief glimpse of true happiness and then to have it snatched from my grasp only served to emphasize this idea. Life is cruel. The maxim my father was so fond of quoting. One should accept that fact. You don't complain, you get on with it. The fact is, I have my facilities. Faculties. Yes. I have my faculties. My eyesight is keen, hearing first class. I have not caught Alzheimer's disease. For these things, one must remain grateful. I often think of my life as a steeplechase. One has faced what are the name of those damned fences? Well, whatever. And one now enters the final furlong. To run that final furlong when it's foggy and to not know when the winning line was coming up, or indeed if there was a winning line at all, would not be very nice. So one is grateful. I like to think that I have faced up to my reduced circumstances with a certain degree of equanimity. To inhabit a single furnished room after many years of owner occupation is not the most overwhelming of disasters. I get by, I have my pension, I eke things out, I've learned to budget with a considerable degree of both imagination and restraint. I have discovered that the public library is a good place to be in winter, for instance. Ally this to a lifelong love of literature, and one has a recipe for considerable happiness and satisfaction. Though it must be added, there have been moments of despair. More than moments. Whole bloody weeks of it. Months. The impenetrable darkness of it all, no glimmer of light, nothing to cling on to, no way out. Till one day, whilst still entombed in this sepulchral gloom, I received a letter in a brown envelope. It told me I was to expect a visit from a DSS inspector, a six-monthly review of my claim. The fear and terror that letter inspired in me, the humiliation of the forthcoming ordeal bore down on me with every passing second. On the morning in question, by a superhuman effort of will, I dragged myself to the bathroom in order to scrape off a two-week accretion of beard upon my face, only to find my razor had gone missing. And it was whilst rooting hopelessly around in the cupboard that I came upon the little brown bottle of pills with my second wife's name upon them. She'd always had trouble sleeping. I knew exactly what they were. It seemed like a gift, like I'd been given a way out. Do we really have to go into all this? What's the point? This has been gone about in entirely the wrong way. Scrub it. Wipe the whole bloody thing. Who's going to give a damn? What did she want? Reminiscences of a retired schoolteacher? How I found God? And what are you giving her? Barbiturate poisoning, casualty wards and stomach pumps. Just give her what she wants. Talk about God, for God's sake. And if you can't believe in him, at least pretend that you do and forget all that bloody stupid horse racing stuff. Start again. Bring back the horse racing, but shorter, and then just get on with it. Just be honest. I have all my facilities. I have eyes and ears. I can see and hear. I have not caught Alzheimer's disease. For these things, I'm grateful. My life has been a steeplechase. There have been fences, canal jumps, and so on and so forth, and one has crossed them. I've not won the race, but I've stayed in the saddle. And now I approach the final furlong with but a few jumps to go. After one brush with death, and having been blessed with no intuition of a life hereafter, I was gripped by a terror that no appeal to logic or rationality could appease. I saw my life for what it was, one long, miserable round of failure and disappointment. And the idea that at its conclusion there would be just nothing, that indeed it had all been quite in vain, was more than I could bear. What are you doing? Just trying to make her feel sorry for you, is that it? Oh, just get on with it. Who cares? Who gives a damn? Notions of the spirit or of God had never featured very prominently in my conception of reality. I'd chosen to put it all down as so much hocus-pocus, closing my ears to any inner prompting, for to listen to it would be to undermine a whole lifetime of considered scepticism. It was at this stage that God, how I still have problems with that word, saw fit to send an angel unto me. How would she feel, being called an angel? Is it just making a bad situation worse? Never mind. I was sitting in the reference library one afternoon when I was suddenly overtaken by a desire to see if there was in stock a copy of an English language textbook I had once written some many years before, my only remaining copy of An Approach to Grammar having been lost when the entire contents of my house had been sold off at auction shortly after my second wife's death. Well, you know this next bit, of course. You did indeed retrieve the book from the vaults. We fell to talking. You asked my reason for requesting the book, and I, somewhat sheepishly, confessed to being its author. You actually wrote this book, you said, and your smile lit up the room like a flashbulb. A real writer. How splendid. And with that simple remark, I was lifted up from the pit of self-abnegation in which I had for so long been wallowing, and found myself valued. You asked if I still wrote, and I said no. But you should, you said, and went on to tell me that language and literature had obsessed you all your life, that this was the very reason you had gone into the library service in the first place, that you had always envied and admired those with the courage and persistence to complete a book from beginning to end. And I was elevated. For the first time in many a long year, I felt free to confide. The words came spilling out. I spoke of some of the unhappiness I had been feeling, that the very idea of commencing another book, the awful magnitude of it, only made me want to retreat back into my shell. You were so compassionate, so understanding. I remember you remarking that it was one of the supreme paradoxes of life that when a person is at their lowest ebb, that that was the moment when they were most likely to encounter the God within. I must have raised an eyebrow, for you queried it, and I said that to acknowledge the existence of God was to suggest that life had some meaning, and that that did not correspond with my experience of it up till then. And you said, and I shall never forget this moment, you said, "Are you telling me that this conversation we're having now, that it has no meaning?" I felt a rush of emotion, quite overwhelming. The feeling of being accepted entirely for who I was. And it was then that you suggested I come along to your Quaker meeting. You spoke of the solace you had found there, the comfort, the inspiration. You were not ashamed of your own pain. You spoke of your love of God. And I was strangely moved. It was all that I could do to fight back the tears that were threatening to spill from my eyes. The following Sunday I found myself sitting in the silence with you on my right and attending on the Spirit. And while there was no blinding vision, no sense of having been born again, no road to Damascus, I nevertheless felt strangely refreshed. When coffee was served after the meeting, I remarked to you that I felt as though the visit had been most useful, that, as a result of listening to God, I was now in a position to start sorting out some of my hopelessly muddled affairs, and you jokingly remarked that my God sounded as though he worked for the Citizens Advice Bureau. We laughed. I became a regular attender, and through that, along with my now almost daily visits to the library, you and I were to become firm friends. The terror dwindled. There was some calm. I felt some purpose again. You probably have no idea how my heart was thumping that Sunday morning when I asked you if you would be prepared to give up your day off to accompany me on a trip to the National Gallery, or how it sung when you said that of course you would. And what a lovely afternoon it was. We laughed as I told you of the disastrous school trip that I had organised there some 50 years before, how the boys had done nothing but snigger at the nudes, insult the gallery staff and attempt to steal sticky buns from the cafe. You said it would make a good chapter in a comic novel. Maybe that's when the idea was first sown. That was the first of many pleasant afternoons together. Not always art galleries. You were very keen on French cinema. Somewhere up in Hampstead, they were showing La Belle et la Bête. I'd never heard of it, would never even have thought of going in normal circumstances, but these weren't normal circumstances. And if it was going to please you, then it was going to please me, too. It turned out to be a version of the old fairy story Beauty and the Beast. The beast will only be released from the prison of his pain and ugliness when a young woman loves him entirely for who he is. It could so easily have been about you and me. And I thought to myself, has she brought me here on purpose? Is she trying to tell me something? A thought which I instantly dispelled from my mind, for I was trying to persuade myself that I regarded you as the daughter I never had. But that was a lie, because, of course, there was an attachment. I couldn't help myself. I tried to keep it hidden, but there was an attachment, nevertheless, one that was growing increasingly deep. So it was with some degree of alacrity that I accepted your invitation to supper. I remember observing to myself that it all seemed as though it were part of some divine plan. Our first meeting, our shared spirituality, our love of art and cinema, and now this opportunity to encounter one another on more intimate terms. Supper was vegetarian. Chickpeas and spinach served with a couscous salad. I must confess, I'd never so much as heard of couscous up until that evening. I recall remarking when it was over that, as a lifelong carnivore, I had viewed the meal with a certain degree of trepidation, but that in spite of that fact, I had found it quite palatable. There was some wine. Tongues were loosened. I spoke to you of my two disastrous marriages, my unhappy relationship with my father, the disappointment of my career. I even, for the first time in many a long year, recalled some moments from my childhood. My nanny, whom I loved so very, very dearly, and who had been snatched away from me when I was such a little boy. And of the mother that I never knew, who had given up her life in giving birth to me, despite all my father's best efforts to save her, and of the sense that because of that one overwhelming fact, one's life had been utterly blighted from the moment one had been ripped from the womb. You said to me, he must have loved her a very great deal. And it had never crossed my mind up until that moment that my father might have been capable of loving anyone. And the very suggestion of that was enough to bring tears to my eyes. All that anger and contempt, bitterness and recrimination dissolved in a second as I became aware that I had lived my entire life in the shadow of his grief. And for one burning moment I wanted to reach out to him over the long, painful years and clutch him to my heart. There was a deep silence, one in which you were quite happy to dwell, and in that silence I came to realise that if my father had been capable of love and had been loved in return, what was to prevent that experience being denied to me? And that's when you suggested I write it all down, that it would make an interesting book, and I said I wouldn't know how, and you said it might make it easier if I just spoke it all into a tape recorder. And that even if it all came to nothing, it would still be useful therapy for me, a way of coming to terms with myself, of understanding myself a little better. And I was immensely moved by your concern, and I said I would. It must have been around that stage in the evening that it all started to go so sadly wrong. To attribute it to the drink would at least be some excuse, but the fact is, I wasn't drunk. I was simply intoxicated with you. I said to you of the huge age difference between us, notwithstanding that I could not help but find you a very attractive woman, and I rested my arm upon yours. I was, of course, aware that you flinched, but I'd been fantasizing this moment almost from the day I met you, and once I'd started, I felt unable to stop. It all came flooding out, my feelings for you, my love for you. The way that ever since that first encounter in the library, I had been unable to get you out of my thoughts. How, although I was nigh on 40 years your senior, that I still had longings that yearned to be satisfied, that there was no reason on God's earth if there were two people who felt strongly for one another, that they shouldn't fulfil their passion, whatever their ages. And with every word I spoke, I felt you shrink further and further from me. And yet, with a persistence born of blind infatuation, I persisted till every scrap of conceivable damage had been done. You retained your dignity. You forced a smile. You ordered me a taxi. The following Sunday, you did not attend the meeting, nor the two subsequent Sundays. People have been concerned. They have asked me about you, knowing that we were friends, and I have replied that I have no knowledge. On several occasions I have asked for you at the library, but you were always busy with administration or out visiting the branches. I'm not a fool. Well, not that kind of fool, anyway. Till today, thinking of you, as I have thought of you more or less ceaselessly ever since that disastrous night, I purchased a blank cassette tape and thought I would fulfil the assignment you set me. Some thoughts, reflections, some stories from my life, basis for a possible book, and if not a book, good for my soul, that sort of thing. Thought I might make the tape and drop it off at the library in the hope that you would listen to it, and that it might thereby prove the means whereby we could renew our friendship, put right some of the damage, heal the wounds, so to speak. That if I were to give you a solemn undertaking that my behaviour at the supper was an aberration, that you would somehow... What's the use? She's not going to listen to this. Can you blame her? Best off to forget the whole thing, put it all behind you. There never was any God. That stirring in your heart, that was nothing to do with God. That was all too bloody human. So, forget it. Write it off as a bit of a bad job, like so much of your life. Can you even bear to listen?
I have all my facilities. I have eyes and ears. I can see and hear. I have not caught Alzheimer's disease. For these things,
batteries
I'm grateful.
Have started to go.
My life...
Listen to yourself, man. You're winding down. All the life's draining out of you. I often think of Nanny now, whether awake or in my dreams. The little I know of love I learned from her, and yet it has sustained me. Will she be waiting there to meet me, I wonder, with her eyes as blue as a summer sky? If there is any mercy, any justice at all, she will. But that's a big if. Perhaps one shouldn't choose to dwell anymore.
Bernard Cribbins played the old man in The Final Furlong by Christopher Reason. The director was Martin Jenkins.